ready to go.
Actually, we got a lot of sales today. We got soup and we got
super delicious.
Okay, wow, very good. Okay.
A cold day.
Yeah, it's cold out there. It's rainy and cold. It gets to your bones. It happens in the winter sometimes, you get the draft from that door. Okay, so today we're going to discuss, I think this will be the last food topic, unless I forgot something. I forgot a food topic, you remind me. I think it's the last food topic. And the topic today will be the promotion of milk. That'll be our topic today. Which I think is probably the most prominent problem in a kosher kitchen, is that keeping the meat and milk separate. If you're trying to keep your kitchen kosher, typically you're not going to have pork chops in the kitchen. I'm not going to have lobster in the kitchen. I'm not going to have blood in the kitchen. I'm not going to have frittata in the kitchen. What you'll have in the kitchen is meat and milk together. That's usually the challenge in a kitchen which is attempting to become kosher, is the meat and milk, separating the dishes, separating the milk from the meat. So I want to discuss that prohibition in terms of what the symbolism is behind it and some of the basic laws. So, yes?
Everybody knows about the 6 hours between meat and milk, but then there's 6 hour cheese. I was wondering if you can, that in the conversation also.
Okay, I can, that's not so well known. I'll toss that in a minute.
You throw in something about the kaling also.
Okay, fine. I wasn't going to get so much into that, but I'll mention all of that as well. Yeah. The questions are there, we'll talk about it. So let's just start from the basics. The Torah says three times, word for word, the same verse. The verse says, Lo sivashel gadi v'chalev yimo. One should not cook a kid in its mother's milk. That's the verse in the Torah said three times. The rabbis tell us that the fact that it says kid, it doesn't mean specifically a kid, a baby goat. It means any, what's called a behemoth, any animal which we described last week as farm animals, as opposed to wild animals. The rabbis tell us the milk of its mother also doesn't mean only its mother's milk, it means any milk of those species which follow this prohibition. And then and it says, it's funny because there's a halacha which discusses if a miracle happens and a father gives milk, we at least pass the milk, yeah. Because there's a few stories in the Talmud that actually relate to that miracle. So it's not a joke, yeah. It does come up. Not a common case, but it does come up.
Oh, you mean in cases, that's a good case. You had milk, but it was from the father.
Yeah, but would that have a status of dairy in terms of the halacha or not? That's an interesting discussion, which is actually quoted halachically. And then the rabbis tell us, the reason it's repeated three times in the Torah is to tell us three separate prohibitions. You're prohibited to cook it, as it literally says. You're prohibited to eat it. And you're prohibited to derive benefit from it. So a Jew cannot, say, cook a cheeseburger. A Jew obviously can't eat a cheeseburger. And a Jew shouldn't even own a cheeseburger restaurant and make money off the cheeseburgers. Those are the three prohibitions which come with milk and meat. Which is actually a more severe prohibition than, let's say, a pork chop. A pork chop, a Jew's allowed to cook one. A Jew can even sell pork chop. He can eat the pork chop. But when it comes to milk and meat, a Jew can't even cook it, even if not planning on eating it, and a Jew should not benefit from it either. So it's a more serious prohibition in that sense than even a pork chop or a shrimp or a lobster. The rabbis teach us that, from the verse itself, we see that this prohibition applies to animals which actually give milk, which obviously means they wouldn't apply to fowl, the birds, the poultry, on a Torah level. Also, when it uses the gadi, the goat, as the example, it's coming to exclude what's called a chaya. We discussed last week, a chaya means a wild animal, such as a deer. Let's say a deer is considered a wild animal for these purposes. And technically, according to Torah law, a deer in milk would be okay. Now the rabbis made a prohibition on both, poultry and milk, and chayos, and wild animals in milk as well, which is why we separate chicken from milk. And if we were to eat, it's the deer's example. If you're eating deer meat, you'd also separate that from milk as well. That's a rabbinic prohibition and not a biblical prohibition. Interesting thing. Fish never fell into this prohibition. Fish, obviously, they don't give milk, and they wouldn't apply to this verse at all. The rabbis never made a rabbinic prohibition on fish either. So fish and milk is not an issue. The Torah prohibition is specifically if they are cooked together. So according to Torah law, a salami with cheese cold in a sandwich would be okay according to Torah law. There's also a rabbinic prohibition to separate them when they're cold. That's a rabbinic prohibition. And the waiting period between... Yes? The Torah prohibition is only if they're cooked together. If it's cold meat and milk together, it's a rabbinic prohibition. That's not a biblical prohibition. So let's say a salami and cheese sandwich, cold, would be a rabbinic prohibition, not a biblical prohibition.
Oh, it's prohibited regardless.
It's prohibited, yeah, regardless. Yeah, it's just a rabbinic level.
But you get the reason.
I like getting the facts straight. Right.
We don't know. If Maya just meant it, and that's why the rabbis have said that's what it was meant to be, not to have anything together.
No, but the rabbis are more making a fence around the Torah law. The Torah law says don't have it cooked together,
right.
But if we have it cold together, odds are we're going to cook it sometime too, and you're going to get confused.
Right.
So the rabbis are very careful that we avoid any Torah prohibition. Therefore, they provide for us, you know, some safety net around it. Which the truth is, yes.
Rabbinic prohibitions have a 500-year time limit on it?
No, these are forever, these prohibitions. These are forever. The truth is, as an aside, The wisdom behind these rabbinic prohibitions really makes it that if you're attempting to keep a kosher kitchen, it's very hard to trafe it up on a Torah level. Most questions which come up are not going to be Torah level questions in a kosher kitchen. Usually they'll be rabbinic questions, which is the goal of the rabbis. They don't want anybody to dare violate a Torah prohibition. So they set up a very large safety net around the Torah prohibitions to make sure that any problem we have would only end up being rabbinic issues, not biblical issues. Which I can discuss more at length at a different time, but that's, as an aside, some of the wisdom you see behind the rabbinic prohibitions. That's the basics. I think Judy actually emailed me a question. The tradition is to avoid eating fish with meat. And a lot of us wonder, why is that? That's actually not relevant to this discussion at all. The prohibition of fish and meat is quoted in the Talmud as something which the rabbis felt was dangerous to a person. What that danger is unclear, but that incited halachically that a Jew should not eat fish and meat together. You should wash out your mouth in between. There's no waiting period, which is why traditionally we don't mix fish and meat. But there are some Sephardic Jews who won't mix fishing with milk. So say they can't have lox and cream cheese, they're really Jewish, you know? But they're really Jewish, they still don't eat lox and cream cheese. It's an incredible thing. So there are some Sephardic Jews who don't eat, for the same reason, don't eat milk with fish. That's only a few groups of Sephardic Jews, and that halacha does not apply to Ashkenazi Jews. So Ashkenazi Jews certainly can have lox and cream cheese, no problem. But there are those Sephardic Jews out there who avoid even fish with milk.
I'm sorry, what was the reason for that?
The fish with milk?
Yeah.
Well, the fish with meat and the fish with milk are come of the same source in the Talmud, which would be that it's dangerous to a person. What the danger is unclear. But the Talmud says it's dangerous to eat fish with meat. It's a sakana.
What is this? They use the same utensils? They use the same utensils. Like wooden, and the fats would get in there, and maybe just the possibility.
Right, but even that. So in terms of this danger, it's only the actual food, not the utensils. Whatever the danger is, that's the Phil mentioned before, what about different vessels? Why do we separate milk dishes and meat dishes? So the answer to that is just because they absorb taste in the dishes, and we don't want the meat taste even getting into our dairy food or vice versa, which at times could present a Torah-level prohibition, and sometimes could present a rabbinic prohibition, which, again, I'm not getting into the details of it right now. But the purpose of separating the utensils is to avoid even absorbed tastes getting into the foods. One other interesting tidbit, which is not so practical, but this prohibition of meat and milk only applies to kosher species of animal.
Mm.
So, for instance, if you ate a ham and cheese sandwich, so you shouldn't eat it because of the ham, but it's not a double whammy. You haven't violated milk and meat with a ham and cheese sandwich. You violated eating ham. But you've not violated eating milk and meat, because milk and meat only applies to kosher species of animals. That's interesting trivia, but it's not necessarily practical in our lives. But it's a single whammy versus a double whammy, basically. You know,
non-kosher beef and cheese.
Non-kosher beef, I think it would apply because it's kosher species, I believe, it would apply there.
Okay.
That species
that's
is kosher.
A double whammy.
Yeah, that would be a double whammy.
So you're better off eating.
Yeah. So the beef cheeseburger could be worse off than the rice than the ham and cheese.
I'll remember that.
So I wanted to talk about the animals. I was told you're not supposed to feed your animals, like a dog can't feed him meat and milk at the same time.
Right, because you shouldn't benefit from meat and milk together. So that's actually a good practical example. If you have a dog food, let's assume the dog food has beef and it has cheese in it, so you shouldn't feed that to your dog because now you're benefiting from meat and milk together. So that is something which, we don't care if it's kosher, dog food can be treif, it can be non-kosher beef. but it can't be meat and milk. It can't be beef with cheese. That's a very good practical example.
But you just said if it was, oh no, that
would be. No, it's beef, right? If it's cat.
It's a dog it's benefiting by.
If you're benefiting, if your dog.
Yeah, but you're benefiting because you're feeding it. Your dog needs to eat. The dog relies upon you. So you're benefiting. That'd be fine. Yeah, that's not a problem. It sounds very counterintuitive to the Jewish mind, but that is the halacha.
So they can eat the pork, actually.
Yeah, dog eat the pork, no problem. The dog just couldn't eat meat and milk mixture because now that's to your benefit.
You're bringing pork in your house. It's okay to bring it in and feed your dog.
Yeah, just be careful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a similar concern on Passover. We can't have benefit from chametz either. So that's comes up a lot on Passover. You have animals, you have pets on Passover to make sure that your dog food does not contain any chametz. Again, it could be non-kosher dog food, but it shouldn't contain chametz in it.
Can't be in your house.
So there's actually lists that are made of kosher Passover dog food. It's not kosher, but it's kosher Passover. Go figure that one out. You know, but that's how it works. So anyways, so certainly not mixing together meat and milk what we call a chok. It's a Torah law that doesn't have a practical, you know, rational explanation to it. It's one where we say, God declared it, God knows why, and the human mind can't necessarily process why it is. That falls through on the chukim, as we've explained before. Which many of the kosher laws we would consider a chok, a law which doesn't have a rational explanation, but yet we do it because God said so and God knows best. But, as we always discuss, there is a lot of symbolism to it. There's a lot that we can find which does describe what is the message of this law. Because even a chok has a message to it. And we're allowed to delve into what is the message or symbolism of the chok, even if we can't get to the bottom line, why is it as it is. Just as a contrast, we understand why theft is bad. So the human mind, rationally, can understand why it's bad to steal or to murder. Why one cannot eat meat and milk together or eat a pork chop, or any of those types of prohibitions. So we can give symbolism, we can give lessons, but to get to the bottom line, that we can't do because it's in the realm of a chok.
Well,
so let's give some.
I have some medical input into this, and Stanley might confirm this, that there's a study done of people that had dairy and meat products together because of the fats, mixing of the fats. Their chances of having a stroke or a heart attack jumped up like 500 times because of the extra fat involved with it.
Okay.
So there was a health. You actually can figure out a rational.
So that works to some extent, but then you have to see, is there a distinction medically between chicken with milk versus beef with milk, or pork with milk versus beef with milk, or if it's cold or cooked together.
Right.
So there still will be distinctions made, even though there might be some rational explanation to it.
Yeah.
It doesn't cover all of our questions either all the time. So to go through some of the sources as to what the symbolism is behind eating meat and milk. So first, the Rambam, Maimonides, he very typically takes a very similar approach to many of the mitzvahs, which is that they have roots in idolatrous practices. So the idolaters back in the times of the Torah, before all the pagans, would use meat and milk, and there is some evidence to this. When they would gather together to have religious ceremonies or meetings, they would actually eat meat mixed with milk. So the Maimonides says, therefore, we avoid it. And he points out, that's why if you look in the Torah itself, the provision of meat and milk is said in the context of the festivals. It says, don't cook a calf and its mother's milk, and then the Torah goes on to describe the festivals. So the Rambam says, why is that? Because in a pagan festival, they typically would mix meat and milk together to enjoy as their festive meal. And therefore, when we have our festivals, all the time we have to avoid it, but especially during the festival time, we have to avoid meat and milk to make sure we don't take that practice into our lifestyle. So that's the Maimonides, and typically does that very often. He takes the concepts of paganism and idolatry and uses that to explain provisions that we have. The commentator, the Ibn Ezra, another early commentator, he describes that it's supposed to teach us to avoid being cruel people. If you just take the image of taking a child and boiling it in its mother's milk, that's an extremely cruel and callous act. The milk is there to sustain the child. The mother's there to provide for that child. And not only do you take away the milk from the child, but then you kill it in the milk and cook it in the milk and eat it. It's a very cruel and callous act. And Torah is always trying to train us to be sensitive, even towards animals, to train us in sensitivity. Therefore, the Torah says, avoid such a cruel, callous act. The Ibn Ezra actually connects it to two other mitzvahs in the Torah. We have a prohibition of not slaughtering a mother animal and a baby animal on the same day. So it's called Osov Esmeno. Do not slaughter the mother and the baby on the same day. And typically it's the same concept. It's a cruel act. You're killing out a family in one day, even if it's a family of animals, even though tomorrow you can slaughter an animal. Just have a little sensitivity to it. And it's training us to be sensitive people. And there's another similar prohibition of not taking the eggs from the mother bird, while the mother bird is still there. You shoo away the mother bird and take the eggs. It's the same concept. Is that we have to be sensitive even to these small species of animals to train us in sensitivity. Yes?
I love the mother bird. Would that apply to chickens also? Because people, you have a chicken roost, whatever you call it, have a thousand chickens and all. You have to chase the chickens away to get the eggs?
It doesn't apply to certain birds. Offhand, I don't recall the details to it. The situation where it applies, they're very specific details when it would apply. For chickens, I don't believe it applies for taking chicken eggs in a normal chicken.
It would be very impractical if you had a
chicken. Right, so, yeah, I mean, there's thousands of chickens, thousands of eggs.
Chickens chase them away to get the birds.
Right, yeah. So I have to look up the details again, but there's a lot of details to it. It doesn't apply there.
But the idea of taking the eggs and cooking the chicken,
yeah.
At the same time, you'd be prohibited.
No, so that's not prohibited.
But it's because it's a chicken.
Yeah, when it comes to a chicken, it's the mitzvah is to, because the egg is not considered a baby yet. Right, there's a difference. And I don't think that rule applies to birds. It only applies to animals, not to poultry. Again, a lot of these have some rational explanation, but there's some distinctions made which don't necessarily fit into the explanation. As usual, there's a lesson there, but there's some details we're still not going to fully understand. The Sefer HaChinuch, the Book of Education, and the Shua, which is a later commentary who uses a lot of Kabbalistic sources. So they both point out that Kabbalistically, some mixtures are bad in a mystical way. Again, we don't understand it. And we have a lot of prohibition in the Torah of mixtures. There's prohibition of mixing wool with linen, called shatnez. We don't wear shatnez. Why? It's fair to us to understand, but mystically there's some issue with that. There's a prohibition of mixing crops. You can't graft trees. You can't mix your crops together. It's called kilayim. You can't plant your vineyard along with your grains. You have to keep them separate. So there is a Torah kind of concept of certain mixtures being off limits, and therefore this would fall into that rubric. Yeah.
My guess is most of the oranges in the store are grafted.
Right. So we're allowed to eat from the grafted fruits. We just can't do it ourselves.
So you could buy them and make a orchard there?
Once the initial mixture has been made, at that point you can plant them and use them. Right.
Interesting.
Because there's no prohibition of eating grafted fruits. It's only prohibition of actually grafting them. The exception to that would be kilay hakerem, which is if you mix grapes with... If you have grapes planted along with grains, that's actually forbidden also to eat or benefit from as well. But other grafted fruits, and such as what are we talking about? There's a lot of common... Nectarines, I think, are grafted fruits. Tangerines.
Tangelos.
There's a lot of fruits out there. Those are totally permissible to eat.
But
initially, a Jew should not have actually made that initial mixture. And once they're mixed, you could eat it. So we do find this concept of mixtures, certain mixtures, having being problematic. And this would fall into that umbrella category. Yeah.
How do we view sticking genes in or taking genes out?
Yeah, modified.
Right. I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'm not sure the answer to that. And then these types of questions are discussed in modern-day authorities. I've never actually read through all the material about it. It's a very good question. So let's move on to another, more symbolic meaning behind it. I didn't watch today. Let's check the time. Okay. I got my watch at home, so I'll just check my phone periodically to see what time it is. So make sure we don't go over time.
Check your phone. Check your phone to get the time, right?
Check my time, yeah.
Okay.
Not my phone calls. Oh, thank you very much. Perfect. Okay. So there's another commentator called the Ralbag. His name is Leibish Ben Gershon, I think is his name, if I remember correctly. Another early commentary. And he gives a very interesting symbolism behind mixing meat and milk. He says that if you look in the verse in Parshas Mishpatim, where you first find the prohibition of meat and milk together, the verse reads, I'll just paraphrase it. It says, the first of your fruits you should bring to the house of God. This mitzvah called Bikurim, that your first fruits have to be brought to the temple as an offering, given to the Kohanim at the temple. And then it says, and don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. They're the same exact verse in the Torah. So he explains, what's the connection in that verse? Yeah. What's the Torah's message that in combining together the first fruits along with the prohibition of meat and milk? So he explains that the concept of the first fruits going to God tells us, it's a lesson to us that everything is from God. He's the source of it all. I worked hard. I planted the fields. I worked it. I waited. The crops grow. So there's a tendency to think, I'm a great farmer. I put so much work into it. Look what I produced. So the Torah tells us, no, the very first fruits that grow, if they're offered to God, because those fruits are supposed to symbolize to you and drive home the fact that ultimately God's the source of your success. And that's the idea of the Bikurim, the first fruits. The Torah then goes on and tells us, and don't go get kid in its mother's milk. So what's the symbolism there? We view milk as the liquid meant to support and to sustain and to help animals grow. You know, humans drink milk, maybe babies drink milk, mammals drink milk. And that's supposed to be the basic building block of life. That's the basic food that every mammal eats. And that's the concept of milk. We could say milk symbolizes the God's blessing to the world. That God provides us with blessing. Provides us with wisdom, with beauty, with food, with success. Those are blessings granted by God. So milk is a blessing. Milk is something which sustains and it provides and it helps us and it nourishes us. If you were to take those blessings God grants you, and instead of using them properly, use them to destroy yourself, that'd be a terrible thing. Somebody's granted tremendous wisdom, and instead of using it to help the world, he's to destroy the world. And you know, it's happened, we've seen throughout history, there have been some crazy people, tyrants, leaders, tremendously wise, you know, people who use their wisdom for evil. So that's a terrible thing. God grants somebody wealth. Instead of using it in the right way, they use it just to, they're greedy, they're selfish, they become materialistic, they become arrogant. So you're taking the blessings of God and you're using it to destroy yourself, to destroy your soul. So taking the milk and taking the kid and cooking it in the milk is symbolic of a person taking the blessings from God and then drowning themselves in that blessing. That's what he says the symbolism behind it. So it's the complexity of nature is supposed to take us. And we're supposed to see there's blessings here from God. This should lead us to connect to God once again. The gifts we get from God are supposed to lead us to God and lead us to do the right thing in the world and bring God's greatness to the world, bring God's blessing to the world. If we take those blessings and we use it to destroy ourselves, so that's the symbolism. I'm taking the milk, and instead of using that milk to help grow the calf to the kid, to help nourish the kid, to help the kid succeed, rather I kill the kid in the milk and I cook the kid in the milk. So that's the symbolic of taking God's blessings, using it for destruction rather than for production. And that's part of this. So that's a very powerful symbolism that we find in this prohibition of meat and milk. So again, that doesn't answer for us all the details. How come not a wild animal, only a domesticated animal? How come, you know, if it's a, how come not a pig, why only a cow? But again, it gives us a general lesson of symbolism you find in this prohibition. And it teaches us that we have to make sure that when we do have a blessing from God, we use it appropriately. God gives us His blessings in order to succeed and to help further our cause and further the world, to be productive with them, and not to be destructive with them. And that's a lesson to us. Another symbolism is quoted from the commentary, the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel writes, and I'll tell you this one, we have to check if this actually is a common occurrence. But he says it's very common that a baby goat will kick its mother as it's nursing. I'm not sure if it's true. Check it out. He says that a baby goat commonly will kick its mother while it's nursing. So the goat is showing its lack of gratitude towards its mother. The mother's there nursing the baby goat. The baby goat's supposed to be nourished from this milk. And it's there kicking the mother at the time.
People are like that,
too. Yeah, that happens. Yeah, for sure.
You do them a favor and then
they come right back at you. 100%. So the message of prohibition is that if we're ungrateful to God, God grants us all these blessings. We're ungrateful to God. So just like that baby goat kicks its mother, that goat now deserves to be boiled in the mother's milk. It's showing its lack of gratitude. You know, that's the message of it. So we don't want to be that. We don't want to be that goat. We want to make sure that we do not deserve being destroyed by the blessings granted towards us. So if we show gratitude towards God, so that means that the blessings we've given are succeeding, and God has given us blessings. We recognize God as the source of it all. If we don't recognize those blessings, and we don't show our gratitude towards God for the blessings He grants us, so then it's as if, you know, we are now fit to be destroyed by those blessings. Those blessings can turn into curses. That's the message of it. So don't act in a way which shows that you're ungrateful, and then that means we'll have to cook you, God forbid, in the blessings granted to you. Rather, be grateful to God and keep and make sure that you're not deserving of being destroyed by those blessings. So it's a little similar to the last point, a little bit different, though. And it's a message of gratitude. The final thought I want to discuss, and I think probably the most profound and the longest one, which will take us a few minutes to get through, is a thought from Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. Rav Hirsch, you know, was a great German scholar in the 1800s, has very beautiful writings. I think I've recommended him before. If you ever want to pick up just a very beautiful commentary on the Torah, Rav Hirsch's commentary is beautiful. He gives you breadth, he gives you depth, he gives you everything. I'm a very big fan of Rav Hirsch. He originally wrote it in German. It was translated from German into English and Hebrew. The original English one was kind of like an old-style poetic English, which I find to be beautiful. But they just recently put out a new English translation of it in more modern English. So for those who don't like reading the poetic old English, so then the new one is normal English that we speak nowadays. That's the new one. I think Feldheim published the new one. But the he builds up a very beautiful thought about meat and milk. I think I mentioned this thought in this class maybe last year or 2 years ago, but it's definitely worth reviewing, and if you forgot it, then we'll remember this at this point, the original thought. But the thought is as follows. Rav Hirsch writes a very interesting thing. He says that there must be a great symbolism of prohibition. Why is that? Because when it comes to foods that are just forbidden to eat, so one can say maybe it has a bad effect on your health. We discussed it can have a bad effect on your emotions, can have a bad effect on your soul. That's when you eat it. But meat and milk, we said the prohibition is even to cook it, not just to eat it. So it can't just be that ingesting it is a problem. Even just having the things together is essentially bad. There's something bad about meat and milk just being together, even if we don't actually eat the meat and milk. Because the Torah prohibits, I mean, in the simple reading of the verses, don't cook a calf that's mother's milk. Let's think about eating it. The rabbis tell us that since they repeat it three times, one of the repetitions is to teach us not to eat it. But essentially, the problem is the actual mixture together is problematic. So it must be there's some deep symbolism in these two things just being mixed. What's that symbolism? So we'll go off and explain a concept, then we'll come back into meat and milk. Rav Hirsch explains a fascinating concept, you know, very very deep and descriptive, you know, an analysis of life. He says that you have three categories of living beings. If you break it down in a simple manner, you have plant life, you have animal life, and then you have the human being. These are our three general categories of living beings. Plant life, its basic function is it provides, it takes in nourishment and reproduces. That's what plants do. I mean, they look beautiful to us, they might give us fruit. Ultimately, the purpose of the fruit is to spread the seeds to reproduce. That's why plants produce fruit. And the plant's function all day long is to take in its nutrients, photosynthesis, water. You have carnivorous plants, they eat the flies, and then reproduce. It puts off seeds, it puts off whatever it puts off to reproduce. That's what it does. That's all plants really do. Ultimately, that's a life of a plant. Animal life, Rav Hirsch describes, they're basically complex, sophisticated plants. Why is that? Because ultimately, an animal's goals are to survive, to eat, take in nourishment, and reproduce. That's what animals do. They happen to do it in a much more sophisticated way than plants. Animals have prowess, they have smarts, they have ambition, they have ways to attack and ways to hide and ways to store things, and animals can be very intelligent beings. But ultimately, an animal is a plant that has a lot more capability, because the animal's bottom line goals are the same goals as the plant, which is to survive, take in nourishment, and reproduce. That's the animal's ultimate goal. It's very hard to find an animal involved in any activity which isn't one of those two. Either their activity is in order to survive, or the activity is to reproduce. One of those two activities. So that's what animals do. So we'll call it an animal is a sophisticated plant with a lot of ability, a lot of prowess, a lot of smarts. But ultimately, the same goals of a plant are the goals of an animal. A human has to be totally different. According to the Torah, a human is not at all like an animal. Yes, he might have some physical comparison to an animal, but our purpose, our goals have to be totally different than an animal. Because human life, we have a soul. When a human was created, God breathed into us the soul of life, which gave us a higher purpose. We have a system of morality, of ethics, of sanctity, spirituality, and ability to connect to God. That's a human being. Animals don't have that drive. Plants don't have the drive for sure. A human being has that soul, which gives us a much higher purpose than animals or plants. That's the human being. So it takes, what the animal does is that it takes its unique animal capabilities and it channels them back into the plant goals. Animal says, I'm very powerful, I'm strong, I can be cunning, I can be sneaky, I can hide, but it's all just channeling it back to what the plant wants to do, which is to survive and reproduce. The human being, our job has to be that we take our human side which is our human intellect, our human abilities, and we channel it in a different direction. We can't just use our human capabilities in order to become plants once again. If we channel our human capabilities only into being plants, then all we're trying to do is taking our nourishment, survive, and reproduce. So then we're just lowering ourselves back to being sophisticated animals, which are sophisticated plants. And we're ignoring the fact that we have a soul and a higher purpose. What a human being has to do is take their unique abilities, which ultimately is in the human intellect, which then controls the rest of the body, and channel it into a higher cause, to morality, to ethics, to sanctity, to the divine, to connecting with God. That's what we're trying to do. We can't be dominated by our plant side, which we do have a plant side. Every human has a drive to just eat and drink and reproduce, and we have that side to us, but we have to make sure that we dominate that plant side, and we make sure that that's in our control. There's a fascinating difference between animals typically and a human being. Human stands upright, and animals stand on all fours. So Rav Hirsch points out, there's other commentaries that explain this as well, it's because the human position standing upright is to show what life's all about. So we have our head on top, because our intellect has to be controlled, the rest of us. We then have our hearts and our lungs, which kind of correspond to let's call it the ambitions and the emotions and the animal side of ourselves. And then you have the stomach and the reproductive system, which corresponds to the plant life of ourselves. And that's how the human being stands up. We have our heads on top, which means the intellect has to be first, and that intellect now dominates the rest of the body. The Hebrew word for king is melech. The letter is melech, so a lot of the Hasidic works describe that the first letter of melech is a mem, which corresponds to the moach, the brain. The second letter, lamed, is the lev, it's the heart. The third letter is the chaf, the klaios, which is the kidneys. So it's a king. How does a person regal? How does a person kingly as a human being? Make sure that our head comes first, and it controls our heart, which controls our physical instincts, which are our kidneys, our gut. That's how we view it. If you flip that word around, if you let your gut, your stomach, control your heart, control your brain, so the word backward is kalim, it's destruction. So it's if you do it right, your head's on top, then comes your heart and your emotions, then comes your stomach, and that makes you a melech, and you're a king. If you let your stomach control the rest of you, now you're destructive. That's kalim, that's destruction. So that's that image. Animals walk on all fours, which means that their head and all their systems are in line with one another. Because the animal, as we said, just lets everything focus right back on their animal on the plant goals, which is just the nourishment and the reproduction. So therefore, they don't have any hierarchy of what leads what, because everything's going for the same goal. But as a human being, we have to make sure that our brains control the rest of our body, and we dominate all of our animalistic and plant drives. So how does this relate to meat and milk? That's probably what I was wondering right now. So Rav Hirsch describes a fascinating thing. He says that symbolically, milk represents plant life. Why is that? Because what is the basic function of milk? It's the basic building block of human life. There's nourishment. That's what babies drink. And reproduction. When a male reproduces, they produce milk. So milk represents reproduction and survival and nourishment. It's, a baby, you reproduce a baby, and the mother gives birth. Now the mother produces milk, and the baby eats the milk. And that's our first nourishment in life. So that represents plant goals. That represents the drive for survival and the drive for reproduction. Meat, the flesh, Rav Hirsch describes, it represents the animal world. Because the hallmark of animal strength is in their flesh, in their muscle. We see in the meat the ambition of an animal. We see in the flesh of the animal its animal side. In the milk, we see the plant side of every being. In the meat, we see the animal side of every being. Because it's a very powerful being, which is seen through its flesh, through its meat. So Rav Hirsch describes mixing these two things is anathema for Jews, off limits. Why is that? Because if I mix the animal side with the plant side, if I mix the animal skills, and animal wisdom, and animal capabilities with plant goals, so at that point what I'm doing is I'm saying that all of my unique talents are going to be channeled once again back towards plant goals, towards reproduction, towards nourishment, towards survival. We have to make sure that we use our human minds and we keep these things separate. I have goals, and they're proper, and they're normal. We have to eat, we have to survive, and we have to reproduce. It's meant to reproduce. So that's what you have to do. We have skills, capabilities like animals. We have ambition. We have smarts. We have cunning. We have everything needed that animals have as well. We have to keep them separate. We have to use our mind to say, meat stays here, milk stays here, and I'm in control. I can't let my skill and my wisdom and my capabilities just channel themselves right back into being plants. I have to use my mind to make sure I'm in control of it. I dominate my meat, I dominate my milk. Those two things can't mix. So what our version is describing to us is a very profound concept. Saying, what is this, what it means to be human? Being human means that we understand we have everything in us that a plant has and an animal has. And we would be animals if we were to let our animal side, our unique capabilities, which the animals have beyond plants, just channel themselves back into the physical drives of a plant, which is just to reproduce. I mean, the drive for food, for money, for women, those types of drives that you find in the human being, those are all within plants as well on a plant level. I mean, that's nourishment, reproduction. That's what those are, survival. So we have to make sure that our unique capabilities that we have stay separate from that. They don't get channeled back into that. So we use our minds, and we say the meat stays here, the milk stays here, and I eat them, and I want to eat them, but the two do not mix together. So that's a very profound thought from Rav Hirsch. And to add to it, he describes that this only applies to kosher species, as we said. Because even if you're in the realm of things which are acceptable to us, a kosher species, you still can't let that make you animalistic. So if you're eating a kosher steak, but you're eating it like a pig, let's call it, excuse me for that expression, so then, again, you're taking a kosher steak and you're becoming an animal with it. So even in the realm of kosher steaks, we have to make sure the kosher steak does not become animalistic. So keep the kosher steak separate from the milk, because the milk tells us that's our plant side, our basic, you know, drive for nourishment and reproduction. The meat is that drive for skills and ambition and wisdom. Those two things have to stay apart. And I use my human intellect to keep those two things apart. So based on that, the provision of meat and milk is the hallmark of what it means to be a human being. That's how far it goes. And that's why it's such a severe prohibition, in that we don't eat it, we don't cook it, we don't benefit from it. Because it's something which means, if the Torah is teaching you what it means to be a human being versus an animal, this is one of the primary lessons, which the human being has to use their intellect to control and to moderate and to channel themselves towards higher goals, rather than just sinking down to being a sophisticated plant once again. So animals we look at as sophisticated plants, the human being is a totally different creation which has much higher goals than a plant or animal could ever have. So that's, yeah.
How far do you carry the not benefit from it? Suppose you're a landowner. Could you have McDonald's on your property?
That's a good question. I'm not sure how far it goes. That's a very good question.
Can you repeat the question? We didn't hear it.
He's saying, how far is the prohibition of benefit from it? If you own let's say you own a shopping center, McDonald's is in the shopping center.
And they're paying you rent.
I mean, I guess the assumption could be in a case like that, that the money they're paying you is not necessarily the cheeseburger money. That might be the chicken nuggets money. You know, so, right. I don't know exactly where to draw the line. I'm not sure.
Sure. I mean, you could just carry it further to the state.
But there's no reason, as the landlord, there's no reason to say that the money they're paying me was the cheeseburger profit. Maybe the money was from the soda and the chicken nuggets, not
from
the cheeseburger.
From the cheeseburger, too.
All right. So the question is, where do you draw the line? I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure where you draw the line. But
you have to go to base camp.
I'm sure it's a pretty clear rule. It's just more, I'm just not aware of what the rule is, where the line is drawn. But yeah.
You know, the next thing you do is, does the county or the state have the right to tax you because money is coming to sell in Canberra?
Right. Right.
They have the right to tax you anyway.
So I think all those be the same answer, that your bank account is not going to be purely the cheeseburger profits. Your bank account has money from other places as well. So no one's to say that the money being paid to the state or to the landlord is coming from the cheeseburger profits. You know, McDonald's sells a lot. If there's a restaurant that is exclusively meat and milk and nothing else, so you might have more of a question. You know, we are the cheeseburger restaurant. That's it. That's all we sell. You know, like that might be a different story.
But you could say, you could do a set off. You could say something like, let's say, 5% of my profits came from milk and meat. Therefore, I'm going to take the 5% and I'm going to give it an extra 5% and give it to charity.
Can't do that.
Why not?
That's ill-gotten gain.
Yeah, it won't help you. Right.
Well, it says you can't benefit. It wasn't, no. It's because you can't benefit
from
it.
Maybe giving it to charity, and charity should benefit from it either. No Jew should benefit from that money.
But you benefit giving it to charity. It's a mitzvah. You have benefited by giving it to charity.
Yeah.
Right.
So you probably shouldn't do it.
Probably the only thing you could do in that case would be give it away to a non-Jew who doesn't need the money. That's it.
Well, Donald Trump.
Yeah. That would be what you do with it. But beyond that.